This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty has been taking quite a beating lately. Newt Gingrich called it a disaster. New York City's mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, when announcing deep budget cuts, said, "We must choose between pulling ourselves into the late 20th century or remaining mired in the tired and abandoned policies of the Great Society." My guest, Sergeant Shriver, headed Johnson's war on poverty. Shriver was also the founding director of the Peace Corps during the Kennedy administration. He was Kennedy's brother-in-law. Now in his late 70s, Shriver chairs the Special Olympics International. Last year, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. I asked Shriver what it's been like to listen to the attacks on the programs he created during the war on poverty.
The thing that impresses me is that the people who seem to be criticizing them don't even know what they were. And by that I mean this. The War Against Poverty, official name, was the Office of Economic Opportunity. That was a name coined by Republicans, I might add, because they wanted to emphasize that all the programs in the so-called War Against Poverty were providing opportunities, opportunities such as had been given to many, many people coming to the United States. None of the programs were obligatory. Everything was voluntary. Those ideas that it was voluntary, that it was economic opportunity, that it was not required, those ideas seem to have disappeared out of the minds of the critics today who talk about the war against poverty, in my judgment, without even knowing what it was.
Are there other ways you feel the war against poverty has been misunderstood or misrepresented?
Well, for example, we started about 12 programs, brand new programs in the war against poverty. 11 of them are alive today. Most people don't know that.
Which are the programs that are still alive today?
Well, for example, the Head Start program was originated in the War Against Poverty. The Job Corps was originated in the War Against Poverty. The VISTA program was originated then. Foster Grandparents was originated then. Legal Services for Poor People was originated then. Medical Services for Poor People was originated then. There's 900 medical centers giving services to poor people. As a result of the war against poverty, there were programs for the American Indians on the Indian reservations, a program for students so that they could go through college by working and studying, so that they get a job at school while they were paying through the job for their education. That was a program of the war against poverty. Nobody remembers that.
What critics are saying now is that, how successful could the war on poverty possibly have been when, in fact, poverty has gotten worse, the welfare rolls have swelled, people have become dependent on government programs. What do you say to that?
I just say that's entirely wrong. The war against poverty started in 1964-65, and by the time 1970 rolled around, the percentage of people in poverty in the United States had decreased to the smallest it's been in this century. It went from something like 18-19% to 11%. After the war against poverty was discontinued in some respects, the poverty ratio in the United States started climbing up. In the Nixon administration, it began to go up. It went up all through the Reagan administration until it's hit a nice high now. I think it's almost up to 30%.
When you say it was discontinued in some respects, what do you mean? Because some of the programs still exist, and yet you say that it was discontinued in some respects. So where do you draw the line there?
Well, what I mean is that the request I made to Lyndon Johnson back in 1966, I think it was for a program of $7 billion per annum. We were then at $1.25 billion per annum. I asked for $7 billion per annum because that was the amount of money which we believed was necessary if we were going to win the war. Just like when you have a war in Europe, Eisenhower's in charge of the thing. He asked for the money that's necessary in his judgment as the commander-in-chief to win the war. We were not given that money. The war against poverty never had enough money to succeed, not only in eliminating poverty, which may never be possible to eliminate it altogether, but to reduce it significantly so that it would be at a much lower level, let's say 5, 6, 7, 8% of the population of our country. We never got the money to do that. So when I say we started the war, we did not finance the war adequately to win it, and therefore, of course, we didn't win it.
What would you have done with more money?
Well, we would have amplified the programs which I just mentioned. Those were just a few of the programs which I just mentioned. Like in any other war, you would have developed new things to take care of new situations on the fighting front. None of us thought that we knew all about the problems of poverty or how to get rid of the problems of poverty. When you're fighting a real war, I mean a man-to-man conflict war, the old-fashioned kind of war, all the generals know that you take advantage of the opportunities that are presented to you. When we landed in Normandy Beach in World War II, one part of the front was bogged down with terrible casualties, right in the middle, you might say. On the left and the right flanks, people got ashore with much greater ease. Nobody could have known that beforehand. And that's true of all kinds of warfare. I mean, real warfare. Sometimes the left flank moves first or the right flank. Sometimes it's the center. And nobody knows when you start where that opportunity may arise. The same thing is true if you're really trying to run an all-out war against an opponent which is diversified and difficult to overcome as poverty.
The slogan of the War on Poverty was a hand up, not a hand out. What was the thinking behind that?
The thinking was damn simple, and it's this. Most people in our country don't like handouts. That is, where people get something for nothing. And I don't blame them. I feel exactly the same way. So when we created the programs in the War Against Poverty, we didn't give anybody anything for nothing. I'd like to emphasize that. There was nothing given to anybody for nothing. For example, if you volunteered to join the Job Corps, you really had to leave your home, go to a place where you work 10 hours a day. You're on duty, so to speak, 24 hours. It was 7 days a week. This was not a soft touch. It was a tough job. You learned how to work. You learned self-discipline. You had to agree to do that. You could quit anytime you wanted. That's true. And plenty of people quit because they didn't have the courage or the intelligence or the combination to stay with the requirements of the Job Corps. But nobody was drafted into the Job Corps. Everybody had to volunteer, and they could get out whenever they wanted to get out.
Were you personally opposed to giving people money?
Yes. And we never gave people money for nothing. No, we never did it at all. That's a different business. That's welfare. Ours was not a welfare program.
Why not? Why didn't you want to enact a bigger welfare program?
Because we believed that the way to get out of poverty was through human effort, helped by government, helped by private enterprise systems or charities, so to speak. But a person had to have the desire. They had to have the motivation to move themselves out of poverty. When they had the motivation, we tried to help keep that motivation alive and to aid and abet that motivation. But we did not go in and just hand out money to people who had no motivation and were very content just to sit still and take the money.
My guest is Sergeant Shriver. He headed LBJ's War on Poverty. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sergeant Shriver, founding director of the Peace Corps and head of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. I think one of the more controversial aspects of the War on Poverty was the Community Action Program, which required a maximum amount of community representation on the board. Tell us what the Community Action Program was first.
Well, let me correct one misapprehension, which was implicit in the way you phrased the question. It did not require the maximum participation of the poor people on the board. What it did was require one-third of the people on the board to be poor, so that their voice could be heard and their appreciation of what they needed could be given to the other people on the board. The second one-third consisted of leaders of private charitable groups in the community where the community action was to take place. And the third was representative citizens from that area.
So what was the function of the program?
The function was to mobilize the community itself, a particular part of a city, for example, to mobilize that part of the community, that part of the city, to deal with their own problems imaginatively and in ways that they thought would be effective, not ways in which I thought as some federal bureaucrat would be effective, not ways in which, let's say, a given mayor thought would be effective or some other outside group would be effective, but in the ways that the people who were poor thought that they could be most helpful. So we gave a voice to the, how shall I say, to the customers. The customers, you might say, were the poor people. And they were expressing their opinion about what they thought they needed. Just as a patient tells a doctor where the patient hurts, the doctor finds out and prescribes for the patient. That's what we were attempting to do.
Now, Nicholas Lemon, in his book, The Promised Land, writes about how a lot of politicians were threatened by the Community Action Program because by empowering poor people, you were taking away some of the power from the local political machine. And there was money that was going, federal money that was going into a city that wasn't getting rooted through the political machine. And so Mayor Daley, for instance, said, you're putting money in the hands of people who are not in my organization. Was that your experience of it, too, that there was a lot of political resistance because of community people being on the board?
Sure. Normally, tax dollars get distributed through the elected officials of our country, whether there's the local mayor or the governor or the president of the United States or the Congress of the United States. One of the reasons people like to get into politics is not only that they can help their fellow citizens, but because they get power, especially men. Men love to have power, power over money, power over other people. But that was not our game. Our game was to empower the people themselves. So we went straight to where the poor people were, rather than go through the political apparatuses. That enraged political people who had spent their lives trying to get political power.
What do you feel you understand now about the nature of poverty in America that you didn't understand when you first took on the job as head of the War on Poverty?
The real truth is this. Most people who are poor, if we have 30% of the population now who are poor, of that 30%, I'll venture a guess, 20 to 25% never vote. They're not a part of the body political, put it that way. They're not a part of politics in our country. They feel left out, or they have been thrown out. So they don't feel that they're part of the American dream. I think that is a serious danger for the future of our country. The larger the number of people who are poor, and for that reason, either feel left out or are, whether they feel it or not, they are left out, that is a cancer inside of our social system. I don't think that's good for a democracy. In fact, I know it's not good. Those people don't vote. They don't participate. They've lost hope. I'm not saying we should just go in there and cry and wring our hands and say there's nothing we can do. I know we can do things. We did things in the war against poverty which were successful and helped to reduce the number of people who were poor and left out of our system. We made them into taxpayers, not tax eaters. That's what Lyndon Johnson used to say. These people go from consuming taxes, consuming money, they go to the point where they're paying taxes.
My guest is Sergeant Shriver. He headed the War on Poverty in the Johnson administration. I'm sure you get asked this all the time, so forgive me for asking it again, Your son-in-law is very, very famous, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he's not only famous as an actor, he's famous as a Republican supporter. What's it been like for you to have a son-in-law who is for your opposing party?
Well, I grew up in a rather large family, the Shriver family in Maryland. About half of them are Republicans and half of them are Democrats. So I'm not at all surprised to be closely related to somebody who is a Republican. Secondly, I understand fully why Arnold, when he came to this country, became a Republican rather than a Democrat. He came from Austria, where the Socialist Party in Austria was really European socialist in its outlook. And he thought, I think this is a fair statement, he thought that the Democratic Party in our country was analogous to the Socialist Party, which he had experienced in Austria. Actually, that's not an accurate comparison, but that's what he thought. So when he came here, went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, he was approached by Republicans who invited him to become a member of that party. And he looked upon the Republican Party as being more in keeping with his ideas. And his ideas were based on the fact, which is a great tribute to him, that he had been able to come from, you might say, very simple circumstances in Austria. I mean, not from the top upper crust of Austrian society, either socially speaking or financially speaking. He had made it on his own, and he thought that's the way everybody should be able to conduct their life. They should succeed on their own.
So this doesn't interfere with the family relationship?
No, not at all.
One last quick question for you. When I was growing up and your name was in the news a lot, I always thought sergeant was a military word, that you must have been a sergeant. And This is a silly question, but was that a common misconception?
Sure.
Young people?
Yeah, lots of people, even today. Some people say, Sergeant Tribe, well, yes, you know, say, well, what was your actual rank or your master sergeant? But the place where it was really funny was this. I served in the Navy for 5.5 years, and there are no sergeants in the Navy. That's a title in the Army. So I can remember when I come into port, and they put up a telephone onto the ship, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And then somebody call up on that phone, asked to speak to Sergeant Shriver. Several times, the man who answered the phone said, lady, there are no sergeants in the Navy, so there's no sergeant on this ship. It was particularly funny because I did get to the point where I was a lieutenant commander.
So you were lieutenant sergeant?
No, I was lieutenant commander Sergeant Shriver. That was enough to confuse anybody, including me.
Sergeant Shriver, thank you so much for talking with us.
Not at all. I'm delighted to be with you.
Sergeant Shriver headed LBJ's War on Poverty. He's now chairman of the board of the Special Olympics International. This is Fresh Air.